Welcome, and thank you for joining us for the NAHU Healthcare Happy Hour, the official podcast of the National Association of Health Underwriters. This week's episode takes an inside look at Tuesday's primary election results, which saw big, potentially generational changes in Democratic politics with the unexpected ouster of a key congressional leader. We'll review how this impacts the political strategy behind single-payer healthcare, what other elections to keep an eye on, as well as provide an update on last week's Association Health Plan final rule. Before we begin, as a reminder, please take a moment to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and to rate us. The podcast is posted every Friday on these channels ahead of being distributed through the Washington Update, giving you a head start on your weekly healthcare happy hour. Today, we are joined by NAHU's Marcy Buckner, John Green, and Chris Hartman. The big whoop this week for the Washington Update podcast was Tuesday's primary election results, which saw the fourth highest-ranking Democrat defeated by a 28-year-old novice campaigning on a platform of progressive causes, including single-payer healthcare. What is the impact on this new generation of Democrats taking office who are campaigning on single-payer programs?
So last night, I think an earthquake happened in Queens, New York, with the defeat of Democratic Caucus Chair Joe Crowley. It was a stunning upset, and I think the chairman was left very surprised by such a young 28-year-old, very progressive individual. She defeated him rather soundly. It wasn't even really very close at the end of the day. But she ran as a Democratic socialist, someone who is for single payer, 15-hour minimum wage, a government job guarantee. So if you're unemployed, the government will provide you employment. And so a very, very, not only just progressive platform, but really it's sort of a much more sort of socialistic platform than Congressman Crowley, who was considered a much more pragmatic progressive, someone who often worked with corporate America, the private sector, Wall Street, and others. And I think that was roundly rejected in that election. I would look at some of the specific dynamics in there that he was running against a 28-year-old Latino woman in a district that is minority majority, particularly heavily Latino, and he hasn't had a primary challenge in over 16 years. And so I think some of these changes were ones he wasn't prepared for, including a large percentage of the district being now in Bronx when his home base is in Queens. And I think it was something that they were clearly not prepared for, and the Democratic establishment was not prepared for. And it's interesting, we call her a new generation of leaders because Joe Crowley was actually going to be sort of that new generation of leaders that was going to replace Nancy Pelosi and the other 70-year-olds running the House Democratic Party, Steny Hoyer, James Clyburn. He was, compared to them, a relatively young man, but went down to defeat for him. So I think it will be a question for those younger leaders in the House and others who would like to see a generational change, who that can really be. What does this mean for the overall mix of Democrats coming into Congress next term around? I think it's going to be a mixed bag. I think you'll see a lot of new Democrats coming from solidly Democratic districts like this one in Queens and the Bronx that will be all for single payer and all for Medicare for all and for more government run programs. But in some of these areas that I think the Democrats are planning on knocking off Republican incumbents this November, that those Democrats have been running on a, yes, universal coverage, we want to get everyone to have health insurance, but not saying that the government would actually run the program itself.
And I think we're seeing a further polarization of the Democratic Party when we're seeing these types of outcomes in the primary elections and looking at the incoming class of the Democratic Party coming in for 2018. I think that we may see just as a polarized party on the Democrat side as we're seeing currently and over the past couple of years with the Republican Party. And to Chris's point about Crowley not knowing what to expect with this type of primary challenger, I've heard a lot of reviews, especially this morning, and some people are criticizing the reviews of this outcome as saying, well, people are only surprised because the media wasn't following it earlier, and that if they had been following it all along, they would have heard some things that Chris kind of hinted at about the ability for Crowley to really be able to relate to the folks in his district. And you mentioned that it's further going into the Bronx and not so much Queens where his base is. And a lot of folks have said that the challenger really was able to tap into those folks, and where he didn't show up to some of the debates, she was there talking about what the issues were with the voters, and they really turned out for her. And we'll be watching to see how this affects possible other primaries as we're going forward toward November.
He did fall into that Cantor trap where, as part of his responsibilities in leadership, requires him to travel quite a bit. So he wasn't home, to your point. He used surrogates at some of these debates and just wasn't in the district. And so I think there are some parallels there to what happened a few years ago to Eric Cantor, who was caught totally unaware.
Definitely. And like we mentioned earlier, he went 16 years without a challenger. So it's hard to get back into the game of running a primary. And I've also heard people ask questions about what this means for his leadership position. And so just because this woman has now come in and won the primary against him and will probably win this seat against the Republican challenger, she does not take his leadership position. That's something that happens after years of being in the House and working your way through different ranks of committees. So just wanting to be clear on that, I've had some questions about that. Those processes are completely different of how you get to a leadership position.
Agreed, Marcia. I've seen several people in social media and others who think she is now the presumptive future possible Speaker of the House because Crowley had this position where he was ready to take on the next generation. It doesn't really work that way. Yeah, and I've seen lots of people very excited that a socialist could be near taking over the speakership of the House of Representatives after Nancy Pelosi's gone, but I don't think that's actually in the cards anytime soon.
It does beg the question of who it will be, since Crowley will not be in the House, but it does not, like we said, ordain her as taking the place just because she won this seat.
With new proponents of single payer headed for Congress, adding on to the growing list of Democrats already in office, what are the chances this gets taken up in the 116th Congress, particularly if Democrats take back either the House or Senate or both?
I think it depends on what you mean by what are the chances of it getting taken up. So technically, we have Senator Sanders' introduction of Medicare for All. We have the Merkley-Murphy Medicare Part E bill that was also introduced in the Senate. So if by taken up, the question is, what are the chances of something being introduced in the 116th Congress? I think we're going to see something similar to how we've seen something during this congressional session. If we have more Democrats coming into office, if they take the House, there is a chance that we'll see more of this on the House side where we really haven't during this session. But I don't think we're going to see anything pass with the overwhelming support that could possibly overcome a presidential veto. We know President Trump won't sign anything of this sort. So even if there is the support for it in the House and Senate after the midterm elections, we're not going to have so much support that it could override a presidential veto.
But to Marcy's initial point about what sort of Democrats come here, they're going to be in the same sort of position that Republicans are in today about what if they offer a public option? Well, that doesn't go far enough. We need single payer. And they're going to get all twisted into these debates about how far do they really want to go and what camp are they falling into? And then do they then have the votes? Because the margins, while even if Democrats win, will be very, very close, and they'll need Republican help to do something. And I don't see that happening in the Senate, but it'll be an interesting debate to watch Democrats, what they propose and how they line up.
I think if the Democrats take back the House, some of the acts that they might do related to healthcare will be symbolic. You have to remember when the Republicans took back the House from the Democrats from Obama, remember they voted to repeal the ACA, I think 96 times was the final count. I think you might see symbolic acts on parts of some Democrats around that. But these are always done with the idea they're never going to become law, which is why once the Republicans finally controlled the House, the Senate, and the White House and had everything at their fingertips, it didn't happen this time, even if you were able to do it the previous 96 times. Why, with one party in power, all of a sudden it isn't able to happen? And to be honest, I think that's the same thing would happen to the Democrats if they were controlling the House, the Senate, and the White House, of the reality of, oh my God, actually doing single payer, where do we come up with this money? Where are those taxes going to come from? Even if you take all of Medicare, Medicaid, the VA system, the employer exclusion. It's not enough money to really run a single payer system. So who are we going to start taxing? I think all of those questions, again, would be the rude awakening, even if the Democrats tomorrow controlled all the branches of government, which we know is impossible. There needs to be several more years before a presidential election is happening. So I think you might see some symbolic acts. We're hopeful that if the margins are close enough in both the House and the Senate between both the Democrats and Republican parties, we can look at back to some more pragmatic issue areas. If the parties feel responsible to the rising premiums that are out there, if they feel that they will own some responsibility from this, I think we can see some progress. The problem we're currently in is right now the Democrats feel Republicans own the issue, and so all of these premium increases that are coming out this year are the Republicans' problems to deal with, and they plan on running with that in the election. The Republicans still feel that as much as the individual mandate has been zeroed out for 2019 and cost-sharing reductions are gone and risk orders are gone and we have AHPs and short-term duration plans coming, that it's still essentially Obamacare, and so therefore the Democrats are to blame. So we've got to get past this cycle of finger-pointing on the rate increases and really taking some ownership over improving the system.
And I think that they're only going to have 1 year in which to do this, to come together and find some solutions, because then we enter the presidential sweepstakes, and that's when the rhetoric really ramps up.
And even just thinking about the timing of how long it takes to get something done and passed that's this monumental, think about how long it took for the ACA even to really get passed. If we go back to some of the ideas that were the foundation for the ACA coming together in the 90s with Hillary Care and then Romney Care in Massachusetts in the early 2000s, and then the ACA only passing in 2010, getting everything to line up in a way to pass something this monumental, such as single payer, is going to take years. It's not something that's going to happen overnight.
Looking at some of the Republican results, there were two races of particular note. One was in Utah, where former Massachusetts governor and 2012 presidential nominee Mitt Romney won the nomination for the Senate seat. Another election of note took place in New York, which was previewed in NAHU's Washington Update HUPAC Roundup last week. Trump-backed incumbent Dan Donovan from Staten Island soundly defeated his predecessor Michael Grimm, who resigned in 2015 in the wake of a tax fraud case. Based on these two elections, what can we extrapolate as we look at the likely Republican class taking office next year?
So they say all politics is local, and it's based on the strength of the candidate that you have who can tell their story, raise money locally, and define themselves and not be defined by someone else. Donovan, when he won that seat after the resignation of Michael Grimm, who went to jail, has worked really, really hard here on behalf of his constituents. He is just the guy who's out there mowing his lawn, and, you know, he knows everybody. And that result didn't really surprise me. If he had stumbled along the way, he would have given Grimm an opening. But I don't think there was an opening there. And then the endorsement by the president, I think, did help him. So in Utah, they have a kind of a bifurcated system for selection. And Romney actually didn't do well in the opening round.
I did hear some people say that they were really surprised by the outcome and how overwhelming it was in the end because of things like that.
But when you throw it open to everyone in the state to decide, got the result that we did expect, and that is that Romney would win. So I think that for Republicans, that was very, very good news.
And for Republicans, I think they're happy to see that Romney will be coming to D.C. one way or another, depending on which end of Pennsylvania Avenue he's on. And it looks like he'll be down in the Capitol building.
Yeah, I think Romney can bring a real expertise to healthcare, creating Romney Care in Massachusetts. And I think that he will fit into the style of the Senate very nicely. I don't know if he was necessarily President Trump's first pick for the Senate seat, but I do think the other colleagues in the Senate, Mitch McConnell and others, are looking very much forward to Romney being in the Senate. It's Utah, so we presume that Mitt Romney will be fairly easily able to win the general election. And so I think he can be an important part of the healthcare debate. I also think the Republicans were very pleased to see Dan Donovan survive on Staten Island and win his primary. We know any sort of convicted felon doesn't make a good nominee for a general election, particularly in a competitive place like New York, or even a non-competitive place like Alabama can still mean a Democrat can get elected to office. So I think they were very pleased to see Donovan survive his primary last night.
And talking about the kind of Republicans coming here, I think you got to start in California and look at the recent primary results there, where Valadao won in a jungle primary with 62% of the ballot. So that's a pretty darn strong showing. And they had picked, Democrats were expecting to pick him off, pick off Denham. We have on the Republican side a very strong candidate for Ed Royce's seat, Ms. Young Kim, who I had lunch with yesterday. Very, very impressive individual. Like her very much. The ISA seat is still, I think, up for grabs. I will say that the Republican candidate there has a great deal of confidence, but she's really going to have to work hard. But what I'm inspired by is that we have women running, and if some of them can win and come here to Washington, I think that would be great.
And going back to Romney for just 1 minute, I think he's going to be interesting to watch because of what he did in Massachusetts that we alluded to earlier with Romney Care, and the fact that right now the Republicans and Democrats are kind of batting back and forth who owns the ACA, who owns its failures, and who owns its successes. And as a Republican coming in, having been a former governor of a state, that was really the test tube for some of these markets that we have in the ACA. I think it's going to be interesting to see how he's able to fit in with the Republicans and how he may be able to reach across the aisle and work with Democrats to try to get some stabilization measures through in the Senate.
I think his committee assignments will be interesting to see where he ends up.
The former governors in the Senate really have been the stabilizing factor in healthcare policy. If you look at the senators who were truly backing the market stability, the Alexander Murray piece of legislation, yes, Alexander and Murray put it together, but the senators who truly liked the idea were all former governors.
Yep. Hoven, Rounds.
Hoven, Rounds.
Their own little coalition.
Angus King, all former governors who understand how the markets work in their own state. They also understand having to get things done and be practical solution makers. And so I think a background as a former governor really sort of lends to wanting to see things happen now and not holding out for some idealistic pie-in-the-sky scenario.
Yep. It's a good segue. A little less political.
Moving to state elections, the Colorado gubernatorial primary also occurred on Tuesday, and Democrats nominated Congressman Jared Polis, a longtime advocate for single-payer and Medicare for all, while Republicans nominated Walker Stapleton. What is the outlook for single-payer in Colorado after voters opposed a ballot measure on it by a 4-to-1 margin just 2 years ago?
I think the voters were pretty clear in that election. And while Jared Polis did have Medicare for All as part of his platform, it wasn't really the galvanizing issue, I think, of that primary campaign. And so I would find it hard to believe that after just 2 years ago, the voters rejecting Medicare for All, the same fundamental problem is still there in Colorado why they rejected it. How do you pay for it? Mm-hmm. And while Jared Polis is a supporter of Medicare for All, he really hasn't answered the question of how you pay for it either. And I think instead, you're more likely to see him govern with the other issues on his agenda that they've been working for Colorado and changes that people are looking for from environmental areas and several different pieces of his platform. Because I think the voters were pretty clear in Colorado. And I also have a feeling like every primary, now that the primary is over, people have this tendency to veer a little bit back more towards the middle for a general election. So on the Democratic side, there was a very competitive Democratic primary that a lot of money was spent by multiple candidates. And you try to say things to distinguish yourself or to appeal to those who are most likely to show up in the primary. And as we know, in primaries in the Democratic Party, it's most likely to be the more liberal voters. In the Republican primary, it's more likely to be the more conservative voters. And so in a primary, people are sort of pandering to that base. But in the general, I think you won't see this issue quite be as hot because of Colorado's recent ballot history.
He's a pretty adept politician, and I think that he'll probably, on healthcare, just focus on maintaining the gains that they made in the ACA and talk about the consumer protections and try to hold on to that. I could see where he would ask the AG to get involved in the lawsuit, for example, on preserving the ACA or stopping AHPs or things like that.
And I agree. I don't think that we're going to see if the Democrat candidate Polis goes forward to take the governor's mansion. I don't think we'll see a huge press on single payer from him working with the state legislators. 2 years ago, when we saw this going through on the ballot initiative, it was gaining a lot of traction, and we were working with the Colorado State Association to try to branch out and message against the single payer issue. And really, once consumers heard about the cost that this was going to take in their state, that was really the turning point. And as we were leading up to that ballot initiative, we kept hearing from different polling measures that it was really close, almost 50-50. And then as we got closer and closer to election day, we saw that as the information was being disseminated, the consumers really became aware and were really concerned about what this was going to do to their wallets. And we saw it defeated at a 4-1 margin. So I think the consumers have spoken here, and we're not going to see anything come up, regardless of whether Polis wins in November.
Moving away from politics and back to policy, NAHU CEO Janet Troutwine was last week's special guest covering the Association Health Plan final rule. Now that we've had more time to digest the rule, what should states, insurers, brokers, and consumers be on the lookout for as it gets implemented? And how does the proposed legal challenge play into this?
So I want to point out a few things that I know Janet mentioned on the podcast last week, but just to highlight a few pieces of the Association Health Plan final rule that we asked for that was different from the proposed rule. One is allowing but not requiring an open enrollment for sole proprietors. The reason for this is that sole proprietors are those individual employees that are also employers now under the new rule, can sometimes bring a different type of risk to the market. And so we suggested having a specific open enrollment period for those sole proprietors so that insurers could better manage the risk. And that was included in the final rule. Again, allowing states to do that, but not requiring it. There was also language reinforcing the role of state regulators and making sure that any plan sold within the state's borders was going to be subject to the state insurance commissioner. And then there were provisions allowing the existing association health plans to continue to exist, not just being grandfathered, but to continue to exist under the rules that they have, and for AHPs to be introduced under those old rules as well as the new rules. In the final rule, they talk a lot about pathways, saying that the old AHPs are one pathway of doing an association health plan. And under this final rule, there's a new pathway of doing the association health plan. So making sure that folks are understanding that there are now multiple ways that they can form the AHPs under the old rules as well as the new. When we look at the challenge that New York and Massachusetts have, their attorney generals have come out speaking against the Association Health Plan final rule, saying that it will invite fraud, mismanagement, and deception. They are really concerned about consumer protections. This is also something that NAHU mentioned in our comments, making sure that folks realized that if they are getting into an association health plan, exactly what it is, how it's funded, what the kind of possibilities are with the backstop in funding for association health plans. And the attorney generals from New York and Massachusetts are really coming off of this from some of the comments that they submitted in March, along with 15 other attorney generals that submitted comments to the proposed rules. And they also mentioned that they think that this rule is contrary to the ACA's intent to have separate individual, small, and large group markets. So they're citing this as one of their reasons of being in opposition, that because under the final rule, you can have individuals as sole proprietors going in and forming together with either large groups or some other small groups that are joining into these association health plans and coming together into one market, which was really not the intent of the ACA at all. So we are waiting for them to file their lawsuit and see how that might progress. But in the meantime, states are also taking action. So some states already have rules that restrict association health plans. Some restrict how many association health plans an insurer can have and work with. Others are looking at ways, like Virginia is looking at ways that they can redefine sole proprietor to try to have more control over those individuals that could be getting into association health plans. So I think we're going to see some states taking action here in ways to try to restrict the market and try to have better control over the groups that are forming under these AHPs.
Well, sole proprietors have to demonstrate through IRS rules that they're a C corp or some way set up to prove that they are a sole proprietor and not just an individual gaming the system.
Excellent question, John. There will be some restrictions on how sole proprietors are defined, but they did reduce the hours from 30 hours to 20 hours in the final rule of how many hours per week the sole proprietors have to work. So some people are concerned that maybe loosening the restrictions and possibly why we're seeing some of the states looking at ways to refine that.
Yeah, I think when looking at the lawsuits that are going on there, it might have an effect, I think, at some point on the timeline. There's a very, and this is one of the clearer pieces of the statute to understand, timeline of when these different pieces take place, the fully insured, the self-insured plans, a new association, an existing association. And so I think the lawsuit will have an effect on that.
Well, it'll depend. So it'll depend on how soon New York and Massachusetts, their AGs can file their lawsuit. And then what they will ask for is they'll show forth that they have these concerns, the fact that they think it's contrary to the ACA, the fact that they think this is going to lead to fraud and abuse in their markets and their concern about consumer protection. And then they'll also ask the court to probably to put an injunction on the enforcement of the AHP final rule. Because we're sitting here in the end of June and the first wave of implementation starts on September 1st. I don't think that we're going to see this filed and heard at all by a court in time for any of that to affect the earlier implementation dates. And then once we have started with the rolling enforcement, I think any court would be hesitant to put an injunction on the rule if parts of it were already being enforced. So I think it really depends on how fast the AGs in New York and Massachusetts can move and whether it gets in front of a court that feels like it needs to stop the enforcement of this final rule while it hears the case on its merits.
John and I have also been meeting with a number of different trade associations who were interested in possibly offering association health plans. I think a lot of them are still trying to absorb this information. A lot of them are looking at smartly getting attorneys to look at this. And I think one of the early questions that we're hearing from them is trying to figure out to do a fully insured AHP versus a self-insured AHP and what that really would mean of a commitment on their part and the members of their association to actually pull off. So I think a lot of trade associations are very interested in this, but it's going to take a lot of homework. A lot of hours are going to be paid to attorneys for this. And so I think really examining the amount of liability a trade association wants to take on is something that will take some time for them to decide.
Particularly for self-insured AHP.
And to that point, we have been asked several times whether NEHU would be interested in overseeing an association health plan. Our answer to that is no, because of the financial risks that Chris just mentioned here, with even regardless of going self-funded or fully funded. Also, it would put us in a situation where we may be in competition with some of our members who are selling plans, and that is something that NEHU would not do, is compete with our own members. So we are not looking at ways to do an NEHU association health plan. We also would recognize that it would be very difficult for us to be in all 50 states and DC working with all the different insurance commissioners. So it's something that we will watch on the federal and state level, but not something that we'll be involving ourselves with. And then I want to transition, since we are talking about the court system and the challenge with the AHP final rule. A lot of the outcome of this, and also with the issues with the Department of Justice just a couple of weeks ago, saying that they weren't going to defend some of the challenges to the ACA with the individual mandate, and that the Democrat attorney generals are stepping in to challenge that in place of the government. And as we're looking at all of these pieces, what really matters is judicial appointments and who's sitting on the benches in these lower courts and hearing these cases and possibly moving them on to the appellate courts and then the Supreme Court. And this week we had an announcement that Justice Kennedy will be retiring from the Supreme Court. He is seen as a swing vote. He was nominated in 1987 by President Reagan. So he was a Republican nominee and was confirmed to the bench, but then was seen as a swing vote and could sometimes align himself with liberals, especially when it came to social policy. So it's going to be very interesting now having an open seat on the Supreme Court that will have a nomination from President Trump to fill. They are saying that they want to act immediately to nominate someone for this opening for Justice Kennedy. We're expecting someone to be nominated that believes in the strict reading of the law, especially the Constitution. Justice Kennedy believed the Constitution is a living document and up for interpretation, but President Trump disagrees with that, and he's likely to replace Justice Kennedy with someone who believes in the notion that we are bound by the original intent of the founders and the original writings of the Constitution. So we could see a real change in the makeup of the Supreme Court, and this is really going to matter if and when we see some of these cases that are just being introduced and working their ways through the court system make their way to the Supreme Court in the coming years.
As we wrap up this week, a quick programming note: the NAHU Healthcare Happy Hour and Washington Update will not be published next week in observance of the Independence Day holiday. Looking ahead in the month of July, what should brokers be expecting in healthcare politics and policy?
On the policy side, we are expecting the short-term plan final rule to come out within the next couple of weeks. We've heard possibly about 2 weeks. Earlier this week, the president has having a luncheon with some Republican members of Congress and was talking up the short-term plan rule and saying that these plans are going to be fantastic. So we are on the edge of our seats waiting for a fantastic final rule with the short-term plans.
And after the July recess, we anticipate that the Ways and Means Committee will have a markup on HSAs, and we are trying to line up support for a bipartisan solution. As we've said many, many times on this podcast, we think that's the only pathway to victory here and to come up with an amendment strategy to defeat poison pills.
Yeah, John and I have both been speaking to the chairman and ranking member of the Ways and Means Committee, staffers, staff directors, members of the committee. We are very excited to see an HSA bill that expands what you can do with your HSA, be able to pass on a bipartisan basis. But it also is not going to be an easy task because there are lots of people with lots of other ideas who want to expand the caps to put more money in there, or sort of expand your HSA to things that don't really have anything to do with healthcare and sort of just turn it into a tax-preferred savings account. And so there are a lot of stumbling blocks between here and signing this into law, but we are encouraged that compared to where HSAs were 10 years ago, there is real bipartisan interest in improving HSAs.
And in July and August, depending on how quickly the White House moves for a nomination, we could see a confirmation hearing for a Supreme Court justice. Whether this will impact the midterm elections, whether constituents will be affected on whether and how quickly a Supreme Court nomination is secured and who that seat is and who their senators voted to confirm is yet to be seen. Obviously, we have to see who's going to be nominated and how that could affect some politics there with the Senate races and how they're positioned to vote for confirmation. It does take a simple majority in the Senate to confirm a Supreme Court nomination. So they'll need 51 votes for that. If Senator McCain is not there to vote, which is somewhat expected for him not to be able to come back to DC, even if they're doing a Supreme Court nomination, if the Senate can get to 50, Vice President Pence can scoot down Pennsylvania Avenue and provide the tie-breaking vote for a confirmation if we get there.
Some other issues that we're working on that are tax related, well, there are plans to do a tax phase two or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, I think a lot of changes to the way tax reform happened, modifications.
There are technical corrections that need to be done, but it'd be an opportunity to hook some things up that we're working on because Republicans want to run on the tax reform that they did And getting another bite of the apple in September would be ideal for them.
And I think included in that are things like Cadillac tax, hit tax, and others that could be part of that package.
Finally, it's time for the NAHU Healthcare Happy Hours Toast of the Week. As we settle back from NAHU's 88th annual convention, who are we toasting to?
This week, we are toasting to our new subscribers. We were able to increase our subscribers exponentially during the NAHU convention in Kansas City, and we appreciate all of your support and want to toast to you, our new subscribers.
Cheers!
Thank you for joining us for this week's installment of the NAHU Healthcare Happy Hour, the official podcast of the National Association of Health Underwriters. For more information on NAHU's government affairs efforts, or to join as a member of NAHU, visit nahu.org.